Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Thanks for all your calls and comments coming in, by the way. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts, keep them coming, or call us on 074 91 25,000. Right, 7 o'clock this evening, the DL debate is available for you to listen to, scheduled just after 7 on the radio, and available for you to podcast or download and listen at your leisure. Maybe you're out for a walk tomorrow morning, you want to save it up for that. Brendan Devaney's the presenter of the DL Debate. Hi, Bren.
How are you, Greg?
How was your weekend?
Very good, yeah.
Did you do anything nice?
I was out in a wee boat in Gourges there.
You love it out there, don't you?
That's it. I get the fishing rod soon, and a wee hat. I'll be sitting sleeping there, drift out to sea. Nobody will miss me.
Brilliant. You enjoyed it, though? Good.
It was good. It was good fun, yeah. Listen,
I was saying earlier on, like, if you'd looked at the weather forecast, you'd have done nothing at the weekend, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And then it turned out it was beautiful. I saw one shower.
Yeah.
And Saturday and Sunday, lovely, calm sea conditions as well.
Yeah. Listen, I just think with the weather here, Greg, just roll with it, you know? Yeah. See if it's raining there. I go down, hop off the pier, and down Mahargallan, and show whatever. It's just a wee bit of thing with the kids there, keeping them entertained, yeah. Then, you know, when it goes past a certain phase and on the device or on the, you're like, right, let's get out and do something. But yeah, we had a lovely day down at the beach yesterday. So feeling fresh today, you know, ready for the week, ready for the DL debate.
That's it, boy. Right, okay. Big game to look forward to. It is the All-Ireland Ladies quarterfinal. We talked about it last week, Donegal v Dublin. You've Niamh McLaughlin in to chat about that.
Listen, I would, looking at her career, what a player she is. Like, she is an absolute star. And, you know, you talk about being ballers. She is one of the best out there. The way she plays, you know, her intelligence on the ball and how she contributes even to scoring. She's in a phenomenal season. She's captain. And, you know, I was looking back. She's obviously an ex-soccer star. She's played with Ireland as well and been across the water. And she's had come through injuries. She's an absolute leader, right? And as I'm looking at him, we want to talk about Dublin and about this season and that, but I mean, what a story she has. Would love at some stage to have a proper talk with her about her career, but as it stands now, they're getting ready for an All-Ireland quarterfinal, which we didn't think was possible. You know, I interviewed Maxie Curran, her manager, what must have been, 6 weeks ago after a heavy defeat to Armagh up in Lifford, and the whole season was about to go down the Swanee, and they've completely turned it around.
How do we set our expectations going into this game, Brandon?
Yeah, well, listen, we
want to enjoy it because it's a huge game against Dublin, deep into the biggest competition. So you want to get up for it and get excited and hope we can do it and all that kind of stuff. But as you say, we kind of find ourselves in a position that you would never have dreamt you might have been in a few short months ago.
Yeah, it's probably a very important game, Greg, because with the experienced players coming back in, the young players have found their feet in the league, and even though there's a couple of tough defeats in that, they've come into the championship and it hasn't bothered them. And now when the numbers have come back, Donegal now are a force again. But how long is this the last hurrah from the girls, you know? So it might be a very important time. Now obviously them young girls coming through are full with talent, but it might take a while then for them to adjust. So it is probably a very important championship in terms of this could be the last one for a few of them, because we're surprised even a few came back. So I know there's a bit of an injury worry in Geraldine McLaughlin, so hopefully she makes it as well. So listen,
there's been fantastic advances in women's sport. You know, it went through a trailblazing. So there's a generation of ladies footballers that blazed a trail, but they're maybe coming towards their end of the career. And I noticed this in boxing as well. Particularly with the Katie Taylor, and there's a whole group of about 12 or 14 other women that are all now in the mid to late 30s. And it's just on the boxing side of things, you don't see where the next crop are coming through. So what you're seeing is you're seeing matches where someone's had two fights and it's a world title. That's not good for any sport. I'm just wondering, in terms of, you know, the massive acceleration in women's football, is there a cliff edge here, or are the players coming through to maintain the expectations and the standards that we've sort of come to take for granted?
Yeah, well, the players are definitely coming through. Greg, you just have, when you have a team like Donegal that's as good, that's been at the top of you know, knocking on the door of an All-Ireland continually, there's obviously going to be a bit of a change in there. I mean, we see it with every team that has been very talented. It's how you manage that and how you take it through. And then
the transition.
Different stars. But I mean, to have Niamh in there, of course, you mentioned the acceleration of the ladies' game. She's obviously a GPA rep as well, in terms of all that's happening there at the minute, but the girls looking for you know, proper expenses and parity with the men in terms of how they're looked after, which is very important, Greg, because, you know, people say then about, right, about the money that's brought in and how much money that takes and that, but we got to pull up the ladies' game as much as we can. So if these girls are given as much as the men, then they have to get the same expenses and same help with pitches and
support,
training,
yeah, and respect.
Yeah,
I love it. Stand to respect. Going to be a really interesting conversation too. You're joined by Gary McDaid and Michael Hegarty, reflecting on the Donegal GAA 2023 men inter county team. I presume will take up quite a bit of that, but not exclusively. That's going to be an interesting conversation.
Some talking points there.
I mean,
there wouldn't be a year ever where there was as many talking points as last year. You know, having Matt Gary in, and you know, Gary knows Donegal football inside out, and of course Michael Hegarty. I just think we, Michael, sometimes with Donegal, you know, with such a big county, you know, there tends to be sometimes a different mindset, maybe from the north to the south.
100%.
You know, and yeah, you would see that, yeah, a lot. Yeah. So having Michael on just is a thing of balance, because there was a lot of talk, you know, of different things happening, particularly when the protracted management saga came in. And there was reasons for that, you see, Greg, and it's very important, and we're going to highlight them tonight, how this all fit into place, how it came about that Paddy Carr and Aidan O'Rourke was Donegal manager, and in the background, what happened in the Rory Cabinet, Carrie Lacey, Jim McGuinness situation and that. So I want to just spell that all out to people, because sometimes those wires with rumours and that all got crossed.
Yep.
So there was a certain way that all happened, and then they obviously backed off, and that's, and then in the end the players asked Paddy Carr to step down. So it's important we talk about that just to see what happened in terms of the last process, because we're going to do a new one now, and it's very important.
Were you surprised or any reaction to Michael Murphy saying the job's too soon for him? Ruled himself out early, which I think is helpful if he's not interested in it. I think he's got a lot going on, obviously, with the stuff he's doing and the bit of media work as well. He's got
Michael
more
Murphy
to learn.
He's always got a lot going on. It's more what he's turning down, I would imagine, everybody. Yeah. I don't bother him now, Greg, because a very odd time I might text him or ring him for a word, but sure, he's doing really well with GAA Go there, and so he's got the business, and he's Volvo ATU, and he's Glenswilly
talking Minor as well too.
So listen, there's no doubt that man's going to at some stage take Donegal, but I think for him, yeah, it would be a bit of a jump to jump in now. I think he needs to.
That shows
his time.
Good sense too, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think so, because the easy thing to do would take the job straight away. I think himself, he probably wants to look about and maybe, you know, get involved with somebody else for a while, like, because it's, you know, he's obviously gained so much experience. He'll have his own way of doing it. I think obviously his coach along with him will be very important, but I'm sure from that 2012 team, you know, if you think about it, you know, we just mentioned Carrie Lacey and Rory Cavan and that. I mean, if you had them all involved, I mean, you can imagine how the young Donegal squad would.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to sort of, without necessarily saying it directly, and it normally goes around to, you know, talented people who are working with other counties and all, there seems to be a sense of what people want for next year.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, the candidates are all really from that 2012 team, if you look at it. Like, and I know the last time, listen, Conleith Gilligan was approached from Derry as well. He's got relations in Ballinshra there, for example. So the nominations are to come in. You have then a process where the county board can also go and approach people. So last year, Paddy Carr was nominated by Fanad, and S.B. Barrett was nominated by Milford. So they were the two nominations. So whenever it came then to Paddy Carr, Donegal went out looking for a coach because he was a manager. So they were kind of put together, if you like. So of course, in the end, that didn't work out. So it just remains to be seen, do the clubs put up anybody, or do the county board are obviously out. Listen, Malachy O'Rourke, of course, was met a couple of times. Not as an official interview, but he was met. He was the number one target, but he ruled himself out as well. So you have obviously proximity to the county. Like, there's only so many people can travel a certain distance.
Yeah, true. And do you think with the albeit disappointing end to the season, but the uptick, the attitude and commitment of some of the senior players, you know, the more experienced players, and, you know, the young talent that's there, and maybe with a little bit more overview or oversight of how the GAA is running this county, that's sort of ongoing, from have we got to a point now where people will look at this job favourably, rather than there was a period of time where you would sort of say, well, you wouldn't touch that with the barge pole, right? Have we moved through that a little bit, or are we moving through that a little bit to make it more of a, actually, you know what? It's a big county, brilliant support base, decent crop of players. I can go in there and do something.
Yeah, that's an important point. If the players did, and you'd have to say fair play to Aidan O'Rourke and Paddy as well, in that group phase and taking us into that quarter final. I know that didn't work well with Tyrone, but you've seen enough of a young talent, even with all the players not available. People stepped away, retired, but all the injuries we had, and injuries to some of your key men even got in, and we still managed to be competitive. So, you know, it did the heart good, Greg, to see all these young boys coming through and start to become a team again, and particularly the performance against Monaghan was phenomenal. I mean, Monaghan getting ready for an All-Ireland semi-final, we completely turned them over. And that was a team missing so much, Greg. So I think that made the job much more attractive, you know. And the academy's up and running. I mean, under 15s and 16s played at the weekend there, played Dublin and Monaghan and that. I think there's about 10 or 11 coaches back at the minute. Now, from that review, there's a committee set up to get the coaches all back in. So hopefully the academy gets fully up and running and coached again the way it was. But you're right, Greg, there's an enormous amount of talent out there now, which wouldn't have been seen only for maybe all the turmoil. Mm. So if you're a new manager coming in and you get all the players back and get the players fit, we certainly have a very talented squad going into the next season.
And coming in, do you want a 3-5 year deal, would you, or three?
Are you talking to me now?
No, you're not.
Do you want me to rule myself out?
No,
nobody's
asked me.
No.
I'm sure you could form.
We could talk.
Do you know what we'll do too? Stick you in defence, so you can be the defensive coach.
Right, I was great at tackling me. No, listen, Greg, listen.
But you want someone to come in with the sort of, not year by year, say, right, you know, I need 3 years here.
Yeah, three would be certainly, and listen, you could review it after three with a possible five. I think because of the age range of that team, so young now, that you're going to build it up. You're going to be, if you have a good coach and management, and it's going to keep going up and up. So I think,
that would require managed expectations and patience for fans as well. We all want everything instantly. Okay, so the DL debates are cracker. Niamh McLaughlin in. You've got Michael Hegarty on, Gary McDade, Brendan, of course, himself. And also, you can listen to it live just after the 7 p.m. news today. It's also podcast then to listen at your leisure on highlandradio.com. And it's brought to you in association with Sarah's Kitchen at Sister Sarah's Letterkenny. Brendan, I'll let you get on
with it.
Thank you, Greg. Now, the Church of Ireland, Diocese of Derry and Raphoe, has appointed its first female dean. And our Monday focus is talking to that person, given that honour, Reverend Liz Fitzgerald. And Reverend Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello and good morning.
How are you feeling?
Me feeling after a wet, dreary run up from over to here about my appointment. I'm very pleased.
Yes.
I'm very excited about it.
And how important is it that you're the first female dean for this diocese? Is that, in terms of significance, is that ranked quite low down? Or is
it wouldn't even occur to me
that I was
appointed because I was female.
Yeah.
I feel in every walk of life, we should be appointed to a position because we're the right person, right time, right place. And I feel that's my circumstance.
I kind of suspected that, hence how I phrased the question. Talk to me about your early life. Had you always an interest in religion, or?
I would have been brought up in a church family.
Mm.
Like everyone of my age group, we all went to church, we went to mass, we were brought up by our parents and our grandparents to be churchgoers. My father was brought up in the rectory in Coal Island, so my grandfather was a rector. My great-grandfather and his uncle were both rectors as well, so that side of church life was very normal to us.
Mm.
It wasn't something set aside as something different. It was very normal. Whenever I was growing up, there were no females ordained. And I felt my vocation was in the healthcare services. So I spent 30 plus years as a physiotherapist.
And is that where you felt you had to go, or like, did you consider, well, I would like to do that, but there's no other females that have done that?
No, it never, ever occurred to me.
Mind.
As far as I was concerned, my vocation was in the caring professions.
Yes.
Nursing, fabulous career. Physiotherapy, social work, were the three things I was interested in. And I would have ended up in children's work anyway. I worked as a paediatric physio for 25 years, which is quite different because you're not just treating aches and pains. I was listening to your last person who was on who's promoting sort of the sports and looking at sports things. But paediatric physio is very different because you're caring for the children, yes, but the family, you're working with schools, with healthcare services. So I enjoyed all of that very, very much.
And then, the interaction with the people was the part that, I mean, obviously you're there to try and make people better.
You try to make people better, but
there's
also
more to it.
Oh, very much, much so, because whenever you've a child or a young person with a long-term problem, you work with the family. It's very pastoral as well as very practical. So really, it's no great surprise that I slowly drifted into church work more and more and more. In the Church of Ireland, we have positions called parish readers who assist in morning worship, diocesan readers who are lay, who are licensed to preach, but not ordained sacraments. And so I did those two roles. And then...
Was that for how long alongside your already very busy life? So how, like your 30-year career in health service, at what point were you doing both, or was it for the whole time?
Well, if you think that's busy, I'm also a Merchant Navy wife.
Right.
So we will soon be married 40 years, and I think we've lived together for about 15 of them.
It's the recipe to success.
It's a recipe to success. So, what did you ask me?
Did you have a family as well?
I have one child.
Right, so
we have, sorry, my son, husband gets so annoyed, he's not mine, he's ours. I have one baby. Baby's 31 years old.
So all through then, so you've got your career in the health service, you're a mum.
Yeah.
Because of your husband's career, you know, you spend quite a bit of time on your own.
Yeah.
Really, really busy. But it flies, doesn't it?
It flies.
And you manage
It was organised. I mean, obviously at the very beginning, I was very keen on nursing.
Mm.
And somebody somewhere guided me. It was God guided me into physiotherapy. It was amazing because I could not have coped without that 9 to 5, Monday to Friday routine that falls into schoolwork and all the rest. I was a foster mum for 4 years as well. And again, my Monday to Friday work and my boys... I just loved it all. It's life's experiences, which I hopefully bring into my ministry life.
Yes. And you talked about the guidance. Can I just move this slightly, if you don't mind? You talked about, I know it kind of blocks us, but you talked about, no, that's terrible. I want to be able to see you.
That's quite all right.
You talk about you being guided by God. Are you aware of that through your career, or is that on reflection?
I would say both. There would be times when I would have stopped and I would have paused and I would have waited for just encouragement within. I mean, some of the cases I would have worked with would have been very emotionally draining.
Yes.
And I feel that I would have had God's support to get myself going and to continue in my work. But he's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
He's always there for all of us if we would just... stop, pause, reflect, and he is there. And again, I was listening to your previous person who was out on a boat at the weekend in Gidor. I'm heading to Lough Erne for a fortnight, and we need peace, we need quiet, we need space so we can find ourselves and find God in our lives.
I think some people fear that, though. They fear that what might fill the vacuum. I suppose, you know, if you have a faith, it's going to be that. But others try and keep themselves busy. You know, we have this notion that we have to be busy to be happy almost, or we have to always be on the go.
I feel we're too busy.
Mm.
I think we're too busy. My favourite spots would be on the water, beside the sea, and up the hillside. And there's so many of my girlfriends who are only happy if they're out busy lunching.
Mm.
And that's very important as well.
Mm-hmm.
Lunching and shopping and all the rest, but we need quiet. We need peace.
I mean,
we're not wasting our time by doing nothing. We're actually helping to sort of restore ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, not so as much now as perhaps it should be, but if you go back a couple of hundred years, you know, the what you talk of, you know, the fields, the hills, the landscape were more intertwined with religion, weren't they?
Yes, they possibly were, but we need to move with the times and where people are and what people are doing.
Mm.
Faith isn't a static thing. Faith moves with our life experiences. I think, which is probably why I was in my 50s when I was ordained, because our faith experiences and how we want to express and how we want to use it changes.
Yeah, and just by coincidence, last week we were speaking to Father Sean Doherty, former presenter here, who at the age of 42, 43, left, just says, right, I'm leaving here. And his pathway to his ordination was 6 years of study, some time of reflection, then over to Rome, and now he's an ordained priest. And it's funny in that a lot of what he did in his life, as he was saying himself, you know, we present a show like this, listening to people and all that type of stuff, as he thinks it's, you know, it's going to make him a better priest because he's more mature and has learnt that type of stuff. That's his pathway. What is yours? How did it work for you in terms of how, you know, your career versus your, you know, up until you become Reverend Liz Fitzgerald? What has to happen or what happened for you?
I'm going to almost repeat Father Sean's journey. I was in my 40s and I went to college. They opened the opportunity to study part-time. Church of Ireland, we study 3 years postgraduate. And I was able to do it 6 years part-time. So like Father Sean, okay, I did 6 years. And I was ordained at the age of 56 into as a deacon. I spent 2 years in Donnymanna. And then I was priested and I went to beautiful Gidor. And yes, it's interesting when you actually finally stop your daytime job to move elsewhere. It's, and you do, as Father Sean said, you do bring a different experience with you. Whenever I worked as a physiotherapist, I would have had student physios out with me.
Yes.
I loved that. And they just qualified. They had young ideas. They had a good brain for sort of interpreting information and papers. And I had the experience. And I feel here too, I enjoy working with people of all age groups and all experiences because we all have something special to offer. Mm-hmm. But like Father Sean, I feel I have a different starting point.
Yeah.
Because I have had those 30 years. I've also had 30 years as a wife and a mother and running a busy household. So you do have a different reflection on life and life experiences.
And also too, you've got your husband and your son presumably to say, look, this is what I'm going to do. Did any of that come as a surprise to them?
Well, my son just says, oh, Mom's a holy roller. And we just we just get on with it. My husband has always been very supportive. His late father was one of six, and as in every good Cork family, there was a priest, a teacher, a nun, and a secretary, businessman. You know, so faith ran and religious orders wouldn't have been unusual in Sean's family. He's now retired. He retired a year ago. He had a very, very busy year in Rotary Ireland. Mm-hmm. You know of Rotary, they've got a very strong club in Letterkenny here. And so he's now finished that. So I have space.
How does your workload change, do you know, from your previous career to now? I mean,
From physio to now or from cure to where I'm going?
No, from your 30 years in healthcare in all its different guises and forms compared to now. I mean, you know, this is, you're not... there's a lot of work for you to do.
There is. It's very different because in the healthcare services, everything is so confidential, so everything is so time orientated. This is your time with this patient. You write up the notes, you file them, you put them away. You don't finish with your parishioners.
No.
You carry them with you. The joy and the strength and the encouragement from some of them, the sorrows and the needs from others you carry with you all the time. I don't find it burdensome by any means. I find it a pleasure and a privilege that people do bring me into their confidence.
Do you know, it's funny you should say that too, because I can't remember if it was on the radio. I can't remember if it was off the radio or a conversation. It might have been on the radio, but it's a great honour if you're able for it. You know, it is to be able to be offer comfort to people at the time of need, to offer counsel, just to be there, to be their friend. I mean, it's a great, like, it is a great gift to have, if you can deal with everything else that goes along with it. You know, I mean, it's incredibly burdensome too at times, but you're well conditioned to perhaps deal with that.
Well, this sounds strange. I've always kept dogs, and you say burdensome. So, I mean, people can certainly say whatever they wish. I take my dogs up the hillside.
That's it for you.
To the sea. And as the coming to Lochearn with us for a week, we need some way of chilling. And it's actually biblical, because Jesus went up the hillside to pray. And I think more of us need to go up the hillside, even just sit and empty all our woes and our troubles.
Either literally or metaphorically, I suppose. Preferably
both.
Literally, if you can.
Both, very, okay. Very much so.
So you are, where would you be based? What is your role now?
I will be rector of three parishes. And it's the parishes of Clonlea, Raymochi and Raphoe. And usually the rector of a cathedral would carry the title and the honour of dean. The dean bit I hadn't actually expected. It does happen occasionally that somebody from within the diocese holds that, but normally it is the dean. I'm up for it. I'm ready to go. Mm. I won't actually probably move into that position until, I was hoping end of September, but it could be October.
And what do you, I mean, can you set yourself goals or what you want to do or achieve or... What would you like your, hopefully in many, many, many years to come, that you to have done for the church or for the parish, or you know what would you like to make inroads in, or is it simply to be there for people, which is incredibly important?
First and foremost, it is to be there. There is a huge ministry of presence. I want young people to understand that going to church and expressing your faith is not fuddy. It is very, very important. I mean, young people go out, they love one another, they support one another. And that, again, is biblical. That is church. And so come and reinforce your faith with one another. And I would love to see more young people expressing themselves through their faith, which is in there. It's in each and every one of us. A wee bit of God is in each and every one of us. And if they could find it and share it, that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing.
And that would show true independence and, you know, thinking for oneself. I think that's all good if people try and do that, you know.
Absolutely.
People claim to do it, but they don't necessarily actually really do it. They kind of, you know, I think it's good if people assert themselves, think for themselves, you know, stand by their principles, the morals, the religion, whatever it might be.
And I think it has to be a we. Mm. I mean, faith is very much a collective thing. It's not. People say they're spiritual, but really they need to be collective to share that spirituality.
Yes.
And that little bit of spirit, as I say, is the Holy Spirit within each and every one of us. And we need the collective. We need to... It's like if you have one burning coal sitting on the fireplace, it'll die. If you put many coals in on top of it, that glow will spread. And that's how the love of God will spread, through people being together, worshipping together, living together, talking together, having coffee together. It's the togetherness that I believe is so important.
Well, what do you think are the greatest challenges facing the church at the moment? Is it engagement with younger people, you know, a new generation of churchgoers? Is that the greatest challenge? Or maybe it's not even a challenge. I don't know what's...
I think not the greatest challenge. One of the challenges is there are a large number of young people who've never been to church.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand church. And I would love them to have the confidence just to saunter in the back and even sit for 10 minutes and see whether they can engage with the liturgy and engage with the whole ethos and the feeling that God is here with us. That's a challenge.
Okay.
And there are also people of my age and older that have fallen away.
Yeah.
And I often wonder, you know, just come back. You don't have to go back to your own church. You could go to mass where nobody will know you. You can go to a church service where nobody will know you, and you can go and sort of Just experience that.
Yeah, and it's not always maybe a loss of faith or anything. Like, I mean, I would know people who went to Mass every single week and then COVID happened and then they stopped going and then they didn't go back. It was no particular reason. It wasn't that they pray any less or they're any less, but they... It's just sometimes they got out of the habit of it. It wasn't the thing anymore. Yes. Do you know what I mean? So sometimes it's not like a big massive crisis. It's just simply someone's out of the habit of doing something.
And as a very wise bishop once said to me, he said, it's easy to fall into bad habits, but you have to work at getting into good habits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we need our encouragers to help us to get back into good habits.
Loads of kind wishes and messages coming in for you. Best wishes and every blessing to Reverend Liz in her new role as Dean. Thank you for your kindness and ministry. That's from Father John Joe Duffy.
Oh, Father John Joe, thank you very much.
Okay. So I thought I'd pick that one out. And we wish you the best of everything. And I think you're going to make a great reverend. It's clear, you know, with the way you come across and what you want to do and achieve. And congratulations to you.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for your time this morning.
No, it's our pleasure. And hopefully we shall talk again in the not too distant future. That is Reverend Liz Fitzgerald. Back with more shortly. Charlie Boyle is a customer experience consultant and is with us on the programme now. Charlie, good morning to you. Great to see you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good, good. I've been reading your words on and around, well, not specifically, but specifically to some extent about what's going on in RTE and the great challenge that's facing the incoming Director General. Before we dig into that, with such a huge organisation, almost 2,000 staff and the position that it's in and, you know, the conversation about licence fee and how it's funding and people's wages, is it a ship that can be turned around in your experience, you know, given the scale of it and the attention that's on it at the moment?
Oh, look, everything can be turned around, and it's probably in the national interest that it is. You know, I think this last 3 weeks has been good probably in highlighting what's gone wrong, but there's still, you know, there's still a lot of questions to be asked as to how it got so wrong, you know, and, you know, the standing down of the board today is probably good news to most people, but a lot of questions have to be asked as to why this wasn't called a lot sooner than it was, because I think we all were aware that RTE was seen, you know, there was ad hoc sort of information 10, 15 years ago that the culture, the internal satisfaction, the employee experience was not good inside. And the politicians that are sitting on the Public Accounts Committee in the last couple of weeks are seasoned politicians, they also would have known that. But what I think is incredulous is that there was no measurement of that internal experience. So there is no employee experience measurement at RTE. And we're living in 2023 where the employee experience in any organization, and a state or a semi-state body is no different, must be and should be measured. And that would have highlighted so many of the issues that, you know, we're hearing in the last few days. It becomes nearly entertainment, Greg, that, you know, it's about flip-flops or a borrowed Renault car for 5 years. And I think it does the whole organisation a disservice that that's the highlight, because it's not the highlight. The highlight is much deeper than that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting how you're extending out the levels of responsibility, and I agree with you fully. No more so than the executive saying that we were told everything was okay, and then the board saying the executive told us everything is okay, and that's, we scrutinise that. But who's scrutinising the members of the Oireachtas committees who were saying, well, you came in here and told us everything was okay? These conversations were happening in the public all the time. Every time the wages were published, it was going on. You know, we knew there was disquiet amongst the lower paid workers who were asked to take pay cuts, whilst still, whether or not they took a pay cut, there was a tier of people earning hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands. So these questions should have been teased out long before now by those that oversee all of it. Do you believe that's the case?
Yeah, of course, the question should have been asked, but the evidence should have been there to back that up. So the basis of anything, and I suppose in terms of customer experience, where that is in the last 10 years, the research would support very, very strongly that the experience of the end user, in our case, the license holder, you and I are license holders, and you know, we're the end user, and all of us, as are all the people who are viewers to RTE, and that's only a replication of how things are deep down in the organization, that organization of 2,000 people. And again, I go back to the point, there hasn't been a measurement of the employee satisfaction, the employee experience. And if there was a simple measurement, the simple measurement could be something like a Net Promoter Score question, which asks on a scale of 1 to 10, how satisfied are you working with the organization? You give the score. The second part of that question is, why did you give that score? So it's both quantitative, you've got a number, and it's qualitative, you've got loads and loads of comments. That's the information that should have been presented and should have been asked by the ERTIS committee members, not how are things going? Because, you know, that just allows somebody to, again, ad lib how they feel things are going, or look at other key performance indicators like viewership or compliance or, you know, legalities. Compliance, legality is not always a best measurement. You know, decency and ethics and professionalism and looking after your team are other measurements that weren't taken into place on this occasion.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that the incoming Director General, one of the things that he's going to put in place is that all members of the executive are involved in all major decisions and that minutes effectively of those conversations are kept. I mean, that's a solution to a problem, but that was the most basic of things that should have been in there in the first place and should have been scrutinised to ensure that they're in there. I know it's not quite what you were referencing just now, but I'll get to that in a moment. But the big solution is, I think, what we had a fair expectation already existed.
Yeah. I think some of the stuff that has been heard in the last, you know, week or so is, a lot of it is unbelievable. But the fact that it's got to the stage where it is unbelievable makes us probably look at, right, but what was happening in the last 5 or 10 years? Why was this not looked at, you know, more closely than it has been? And why is this information only come up now, when it had to come up, when they were, you know, really, really forced their hand? And even when that opportunity was given 2 weeks ago, the full information wasn't coming out. You know, it was as if there was a culture of, you know, I'll tell you on a need to know basis rather than, you know, for the greater good of the state.
Yeah, and one of the missions is to come in and change the culture in this company. So when we say that, because we sort of repeat it, and I wonder, do we really think what that actually means? We just say there's a culture of this, that, and the other. So what culture do you believe exists there? And will the type of measures that you are proposing address that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because we can't with any accuracy say what the culture is, because there's no measurement of the culture. And, you know, if we go back to the Peter Drucker statement in the mid-50s, which is really, really relevant, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And it's not the strategy or the policies and the procedures of any organization that'll win the day, it's the culture. And part of that culture is how they treat each other internally. So what are the internal workings of that? So the reality is there is no measurement of that. And that may be for good reason, because it may not have suited everybody that there was a spotlight shone on the organization. And a lot of the time, the reason that employee experience or employee engagement is not measured is that it's perhaps the decision of senior management or some senior management not to measure it. But what's becoming more and more evident through lots of really rich research is that the companies that are successful, the good and the great, and that's not always the Amazons and the LinkedIns and, you know, the ones that we hear great stories about, but it might be a small, medium enterprise with 20 or 30 people. And their success is based on how they are internally. And that probably has been the big shift in the last 10 years. But RTE, for some reason, just didn't follow that. They didn't create any measurements of their culture. You can measure culture. You can measure employee experience. You can measure employee engagement. And some of the statistics coming out, you know, from the States, for example, would suggest that 60% of people working in organizations are disengaged. They are not engaged. So you take the loss of that. If that was the case with the 2,000 employees at RTE, if there was a level of disengagement simply because their voice wasn't heard What's been the financial loss there? So it's no point rolling out flip-flops or a borrowed rental car when perhaps the losses are many, many, many more millions or billions because of the failure to measure the culture internally. So, you know, it's great to hear the director, Kevin Backhurst, coming in this morning saying there's a wish now to change the culture. Reality is there's no base measurement of what that culture is. There's only the ad hoc information.
So the only problem is sometimes I wonder, you don't ask a question because you don't want to have to deal with the answer. And there were an awful lot of individuals doing really very well, be it in the executive or some of the more high-profile presenter staff. Do you want to ask the people lower deck how things are going when they will tell you things aren't really going great here? We've taken a pay cut. We don't have the right equipment. We're recording voiceovers in toilets. You know, when we don't feel we're getting the support for. I just wonder, was there the culture being that the people at the top probably didn't want to? Because the thing about media, it's a funny old thing. It can, you can, a lot of people, would almost do it for free. You know what I mean? For whatever reason or another. And I think that sometimes that can be a little bit exploited. And I just wonder if they were afraid to ask that question. The biggest cultural problem is that a certain group of individuals were doing really, really well. And as long as the, you know, the deckhands kept quiet or weren't asked, we can keep this gravy train running.
Yeah, and I think you're right. You know, you asked the question, do you want to? At senior management level, obviously they didn't want to. But should they have had to? Yes, they should have had to. And that's where the accountability and the management and the governance comes into play. But that governance is not only the board of governors who are in there, it's the politicians that we elect and we represent to, you know, to watch our interests. So again, who's asking the questions of the Public Accounts Committee? You know, who's asking them questions?
How big, but that was actually going to be my next question. So I'll phrase it if you don't want to. And I don't mean like heads to roll, let's clear it. I don't mean it like that. But what level of responsibility in all of this do you think has to be directed towards the minister with responsibility and also the Public Accounts Committee, who we kind of expect are going to be scrutinising on our behalf? You know, we can't have a situation where the politicians stand beside us and go, yeah, that's terrible, we need to do something about that. You know, they're very well rewarded for us to have an expectation that they're on top of things like this. So is there any, how much of the responsibility falls to definitely the PAC and to an equal extent the Minister for Communications?
I think quite a bit of it, to be very honest, you know, because again, the responsibility of checking out what was the state of play within RTE. I don't know if, you know, how you felt about it, but for many, many years, you always heard this sort of rumbling of discontent coming out of RTE. Mm-hmm. It's our state broadcaster. This is not news. The last few weeks has not been news. You know, I would know of people who have worked there, and you touched on it earlier on. They are so dedicated that they would work 16 hours a day and get paid 8 because they just love what they do. But, you know, was their voice heard throughout this process? No, it wasn't. Did the politicians and did those who had ministerial responsibility know that there was rumblings? Of course they did. You know, this is not a surprise to them in recent weeks. So I think everybody must take responsibility and say, listen, we were caught on the hop here. We were caught off guard. We were caught off watch. And, you know, measurements need to be put in place. If you're going to change the culture, we'll start measuring it for the first place, because you're not going to be able to manage it unless you measure it. There needs to be a number. There needs to be a figure. Every government agency should have, you know, as one of their key performance indicators, the staff satisfaction rating every year, not how they're performing in terms of their financial contribution, but what is the employee experience number? Is it 50%? Mm. Is it 40%? Is it 80%? Why is it 80%? So that number needs to come into play so we can, you know, you talk about transparency, and the new director spoke this morning about transparency. Well, you and I and every other license holder wants to see what that transparency looks like in its most simple form. So give us a number, give us a percentage, and then give us the comments of those who are keeping the wheels running, you know, the people that run RTE. And that is, you know, those people who are putting in that extra effort and working the extra hours with no return, and think about how they feel today and in the last 3 weeks hearing some of the stories that are emerging.
Yeah, and I suppose the same advice that you're giving RTE now, you could apply to any company, be it a small company with six staff, medium-sized, whatever it might be, this is good practice in every company.
Oh, absolutely. And again, that's where the research, I suppose, that, you know, in the work that we're in, it's not about customer service training at the front end only. That's helpful. But it's about the culture. It's about the what's now called the internal customer experience, you know, what's happening inside. And if you work on that, the inevitable outcome is, you know, a better service to the end user and growth for that organization.
Okay. I think this is the next couple of weeks are perhaps the most important in the history of RTE as to where they go next. I think the public appetite for extra revelations is gone, to be honest with you. I think, you know, there's, unless it was something huge, it would take an awful lot to bother people now. And I think they'd be more than happy, maybe, I don't know, I'm just guessing, more than happy to see this story move on now. So I think the next week or two is critical in that there's no, that the information keeps coming in terms of the positive. I agree.
I think the circus part of it is over now. You know, it's maybe there'll be a wee bit of a media scrum tomorrow for Ryan Tuberty and his agent coming into play. But I think that again, to say, does a disservice to the bigger picture, the things that need to be looked at. You know, getting the governance right and getting the management right, and you know, making sure that the director, when he does come in, is not stonewalled by, you know, a culture that's impossible in the first few months to permeate and to get through and to start changing the inner workings there.
That's a really interesting. Never thought about the resistance that might be there from within, even with the best of intentions. Oh, yeah, that's another one we could have done another half hour on. Okay, Charlie, thank you so much for your time. Have a lovely day. Charlie Boyle there, who is a customer experience consultant. What's your views on what he had to say there? 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. And by the way, if you're listening to the podcast of the program, or if you're listening to the replay overnight, you can text in at any stage. You don't only text in when we're live, and we can pick up your texts the following morning or as they come in. Regarding the issue of sexual violence and the influence of pornography, particularly on young people, this could be addressed in a similar way to how the US banned access to betting sites. A ban on porn websites could be implemented by the state if the political will was there. Alternatively, similar to betting sites in Ireland, an identification process could be introduced to require proof of age via official ID. These may not block all access to the material, but would significantly reduce access. Yeah, I'm not really sure. In this day and age, how bans on how you access stuff on the internet, there's so many different sources from it. Telegram, for example, you know, Twitter, there's more pornography on Twitter than there is on the internet almost, and other places. I know exactly where you're coming from. I just don't see, especially with virtual private networks and how young people could circumnavigate that, and it could even become more attractive if it's harder to get at. Definitely something we need to perhaps explore how it might work. Not 100% sure. The number of Ukrainian pupils enrolled in schools in Donegal has increased by 21%, is it, accounting for 58% of the national increase. The number of students in post-primary schools remained the same, while primary school figures moved from 859 in June to 868 at the end of the academic year. Nationally, there were a total of 15,625 Ukrainian children enrolled across Ireland, a rise of 36 children. Greg, there's no apparent real change being announced today, with the most highly paid RTE presenters being put on RTE books as actual RTE employees, which means that them and us culture of corruption will continue. So all these changes are effectively token window dressing. The problem is that the big name presenters will continue to view themselves as talent, and everyone else will still not considered to have talent of any sort, but mere peasants in the RTE caste system. Well, I suppose if you do bring them on the books, it does change the level of oversight and the control you have on their external activities, if that is the plan. Greg, there's no point in blaming our young people for the drinking culture. What example are they exposed to all their lives? Everything, every event begins and ends with alcohol. People can't do alcohol in moderation. It is one of the most destructive things in society today and causes many other problems indeed. And just to note as well, which I tend to do, that the majority of young people don't actually drink. Or even drink to excess either. So it's not all of them. And, you know, as I say, even if some of them do, I'm not judging them either, because I don't know everyone's situations. Parents have been doing that for years. This is paying or offering financial incentives for people not to drink until they're 18. Parents have been doing that for years. I think it's a good plan. It's a minefield out there for our young people indeed. Hi, Greg. Just checked my bank there. It also took €125 out of my account and I only put 40 in at probably the same particular station. It will be refunded. It's just an inconvenience. Greg, following that interview with the guy who was overcharged for getting diesel, I got diesel at a go filling station yesterday. I think you could should mention the name and location. I've just checked my bank app and I was charged €125, even though I only got €40 of fuel. Only that you mentioned it, I wouldn't have known. Thanks for the info. I won't use that station again. Well, we don't want you to discourage using it either, by the way. That's not the aim of it. It's something maybe the company needs to look at. Loads of you texting in that have checked their accounts and all of you down €125 and didn't realise it. Okay. We'll get on to the company and see what they plan to do into the future. As I say, I'm sure they would. It is something they'd want to work on. Okay, that's where we leave it on the show today. Thank you to all of you who listened to the show, those of you who've watched the show and those of you engaged. Stay tuned. John Bresson's coming up around the Northwest after the news at 12.